Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and in this edition of Focus on Africa, chemical lessons for women and girls who use hair relaxers.
If you see sodium hydroxide, if you see potassium hydroxide, if you see formaldehyde, then you know that it's a product that isn't safe for you. It's also important to say that lye is the general name for sodium hydroxide. They will have no lye written on the packaging, but then when you look further in the ingredients list, you see sodium hydroxide.
A campaigner for safety and transparency wants to hold the manufacturers of these products to account. Also, all that glisters is not gold, as Zimbabweans are finding 2 weeks on since the introduction of the ZiG, their shiny new gold-backed currency. It's Tuesday, the 23rd of April. First, we go to Rwanda. Britain's Parliament has finally passed a law allowing asylum seekers to be processed and settled in Rwanda. It's been a very long, very difficult process. The bill was contested by the opposition, the courts, by campaigners, and by the House of Lords, another chamber of Parliament. The issue has dominated news and political discussions in the UK for nearly 2 years now. Barring specific challenges, the first asylum seekers could be heading for Rwanda in the next 3 months. The Conservative government says the law will stop traffickers from loading people onto boats in France and then sending them across the English Channel. The Rwandan government says it is ready to receive migrants as part of the deal. Hope Hostel in northern Kigali has been ready for nearly 2 years. Ishmael Bakina is the managing director.
There are many staff. It is just we are in a broke booking system. It means that you have to keep our readiness till they are arriving. So they are preparing foods and drinks for the staffs of Hope Hostel, but we are not preparing food for other clients. So we are waiting for the asylum seekers, and we have to keep our readiness till they are coming.
But on the streets of Kigali, there were questions.
Where are you going to find the jobs for these people? We ourselves, we've graduated, but we've not yet secured jobs. We are out there searching for jobs. I don't think it's a good idea for Britain to continue and send the asylum seekers to Rwanda.
The people who take the decision in the UK, they have to look to the situation of those refugees, because they are people who fled their country because of poverty, because of the war, because of the dictatorship they have in their country. And they will come in a country where they cannot express themselves freely, where they will not have the well-being they are looking in the UK. I don't understand why British government won't absolutely to send those people in Rwanda.
The government of Rwanda addressed one of those concerns.
Our national laws are very clear about the right to protest. It is protected under specific circumstances. And if they do wish to protest peacefully within the confines of the law, they're welcome to.
But let's take a closer look at the bill and why getting it passed matters so much to the government here. I've been talking to the BBC's Rob Watson.
Well, essentially, what they've passed allows for Britain to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda for being processed there. What this bill did was to make that possible, and it made it possible by stating that Rwanda is a safe country and that there should be very limited grounds for appeal for anyone who is about to be deported there. And what the House of Lords had wanted to do was to say, look, fair enough, we accept that, you know, you are the elected government, this is what you want to do. But we think there should be two things. There should be an independent monitoring system to make sure that Rwanda really is a safe country. And secondly, they'd wanted a specific exemption for people in Afghanistan who'd worked with British military forces that they couldn't be deported to Rwanda. But they lost, and, you know, it's now law.
What was at stake for the British government you know, for them to fight this hard to get this law passed? Because it feels like Prime Minister's Rishi Sunak's government is resting on. They had to win this.
Absolutely. This mattered a lot to Rishi Sunak. He's absolutely made this a keynote policy. I mean, he hasn't so much as doubled down on it, as sort of tripled down, quadrupled down, whatever phrase you would use. He has absolutely made this as a dividing line between governing Conservative Party and the main opposition Labour Party, that the Conservatives are in favour of putting asylum seekers on flights to Rwanda, as they would see it, as a way of deterring other people from crossing the channel. And the reason why it's so important is because the polling tends to suggest that many of the voters who voted Conservative in 2019 at the last election, you know, this is an issue they care about. So absolutely, it's a vital moment in terms of migration policy.
Why is that? Because part of this law was challenged in court. Does it comply with international law? This is a term that we don't often hear used in relation to British laws.
It's an excellent question, and the government has insisted it is compliant with international conventions on the rights of refugees and consistent with the European Convention on Human Rights. But, I mean, interestingly, in reaction to this becoming law, a senior UN official has said, and I'm quoting now, the legislation, and I'm quoting, seriously hinders the rule of law in the UK and sets a perilous precedent globally. Because the reason why I said this wasn't just a British domestic political story, and it is hugely important here in Britain, is because if you think about it, all over the world you've got these movements of people from quite often conflict zones or countries where you have very poor governance or very, very poor economic prospects, seeking to come to European countries, including the UK. And what Britain is doing is essentially a brand new approach. It's saying, you know what, we want to test this idea. You don't have to hear someone's claim for asylum in the country where they are physically, that you could actually send them to a third country, in this case Rwanda. And the UN Agency on Refugees thinks that this is a terrible idea and a truly terrible precedent.
Does the government actually win kudos for doing this? You know, does it win voters for this?
I don't think there's any doubt that those who are identified and earmarked for deportation from Britain to Rwanda will challenge it in the courts, absolutely, and possibly all the way up to the European Court of Human Rights. But what the government has done with this legislation is to make that very difficult, because it's essentially said in law that Rwanda is a safe country. And the Supreme Court had earlier said there's nothing wrong really with the principle, even if the UN doesn't like it, there's nothing wrong with the principle of outsourcing migrant processing to third countries. You know, as to the absolute key $64,000 question that you ask, is it going to work? I mean, you have to understand, we have to remind ourselves the purpose of this policy as the government sees it, and again it says that it has global relevance, is deterrence. What they want to do is to just stop people coming on little boats from France to Britain. The critics of this policy say it just can't work as a deterrent. If you look at the numbers, so there's something like 30,000 people crossed last year from France to Britain, 40,000 the year before that. And they argue, well, if Rwanda has only a capacity to, say, maybe take between 200 and 500 people a year, I mean, you do the maths, that would only leave like a 1 or 2% probability, if you come over on a boat, of you being sent to Rwanda. Would that really deter people? And the other, you know, if people drowning in the sea between France and Britain isn't enough to deter people in the past from making this perilous journey, why on earth would a 1 to 2% chance of being deported to Rwanda?
Just for my own interest, once you've been processed in Rwanda, when you get there, your claim is either denied or granted. If it's denied, do you have to stay in Rwanda or you go back to your home country? And if it's successful, can you come to the UK?
I think what people will have the option of is trying again, obviously. They will also perhaps be able to try to apply for asylum in other countries, not just Rwanda. And then, of course, there will be the option of going home. But what this law makes clear and what British courts were very worried about was that could anyone be forcibly sent from Rwanda back to their home countries, their life and their rights would be in danger. And the British government says it's received assurances from Rwanda that that wouldn't happen. But absolutely, I mean, you could see that people may well be in a kind of a limbo in Rwanda, sent there on one-way flights from UK, not able to settle in Rwanda, with not really any other maybe attractive options for them.
Tell us about the environment here in the UK. Is it hostile to people who come from elsewhere seeking asylum, generally?
It's really interesting. I guess there's a slight nuance. There's a difference between a British attitude towards so-called legal migration, where the opinion polling suggests people wish it was lower, but they're not actually hostile to the idea of immigration. On people who have come, as the government would see it, illegally, I think the UN would say irregularly, in small boats from France over to the UK, I mean, the polling again suggests that people are, you know, much more against that. I mean, they tend to buy into the government's argument that that's unfair, it's queue jumping, and it shouldn't be allowed to happen. If you were to sort of ask a further question, Audrey, you know, what does the polling tell you about all of this stuff? The polling suggests that the majority of people support the idea of flights to Rwanda. A majority of people support the idea of doing something about the problem. But if you then say, well, given that the government now has this law and that there might be some flights, does that mean, you know, their fortunes are going to turn around? The research suggests absolutely not. The Conservative government is so massively unpopular here that even getting this law passed and sending some flights to Rwanda almost certainly wouldn't make any difference.
Has there been research to show whether the British public actually supports this law?
I mean, the opinion polling does suggest that a majority of people support the idea of taking action against people coming by boats, including the idea of flights to Rwanda. I mean, the polling also suggests that people are fairly sceptical as to whether it works. But yeah, I mean, there are majorities who are in favour of what, of course, will look to most people around the world to be a pretty hard line. And interestingly, you mentioned the latest sort of tragic headline about people dying in the Channel. I mean, the government makes the argument, you know, one of the reasons behind this policy is to try and stop that. The argument for stopping the boats isn't just because, you know, people in Britain are hostile to the idea of coming over, but actually for the sake and well-being of the people trying to make the journey.
Rob, thank you so much, as ever.
Not at all.
Very succinct, really good.
Okie doke.
Thanks, bye-bye.
All right, take care, Audrey.
You too. Bye. It's just over 2 weeks since Zimbabwe launched its latest currency, the ZiG, which stands for Zimbabwe Gold. The idea is that the currency is backed by gold, which means the government will only print as much cash as there is reserves of gold in the central bank. So it can't print paper if it doesn't have the metal to back it. For that way lies hyperinflation, massively rising prices, in other words. Zimbabwe has tried to launch other new currencies in recent years. They've all failed because the value of the money dropped against the US dollar and the prices of goods or inflation began to rise. So how is the new currency doing? It depends on where you look. The official exchange rate is stable, but the black market exchange rate has already increased from the 13.41 ZiG to the dollar that it opened with when it was introduced 2 weeks ago to 20 ZiG to a dollar today. We've been wondering what this means and why it matters, not just in an economic sense, but also for people who have to live with less and less money. So we called up Godfrey Kanyenze, an economist with the Labour and Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe. Let's start with the shiny bit. What does it mean to say that the ZiG is backed by gold?
What it means simply is that government cannot print the local currency. The extent to which it can print can only be determined on the basis of the external assets that it holds. And these external assets include precious minerals, mainly gold, as well as international reserves denominated in foreign currencies. So it's a way of ensuring that the government does not print outside of this framework. So this is sort of like a disciplining mechanism to ensure that the previous challenges that have beset government of printing money to meet the demands for government expenditures is actually curtailed. So that's the idea behind anchoring this new currency, the Zimbabwe gold, on precious minerals as well as international reserves, foreign currency reserves.
So why have other currencies or attempts at establishing a stable currency not been backed by gold? And is that the reason why they didn't succeed?
Well, the Zim dollar largely failed because of the lack of discipline, as the government itself is admitting that there was no discipline on the part of the central bank. And whenever government was faced with obligations that it had to meet, either through the expanded infrastructure rehabilitation program that government adopted, printing of money created money supply, which fed inflation. So this basically has eroded the local currency, the Zimbabwean dollar, such that it has not been able to play the role of money, namely to become a medium of exchange as well as a store of value. So because of the inflation that is associated with the instability of the exchange rate, that basically has resulted in a currency that could not hold its own against other currencies.
Right.
So basically, if you look at the current scenario, as of the 5th of April, when the Zimbabwe gold, the new currency was introduced, basically the Zimbabwean dollar was exchanging at 33,000 to the US dollar. So basically, in that context of volatile exchange rates, it became very difficult for Zimbabweans to transact using that currency.
So why does printing money lead to inflation, or inflation being the price of things increasing?
Well, basically, you've got your base money, which basically, if your economic activities are not expanding, then it is imprudent for you to simply print your way out of the problems. So the problem in the past is that government would easily resort to printing money in order to meet the obligations that were upon it. So as a result, basically, the printing of money, like what happened in Germany in the 1920s, easily fed into a scenario where there was too much money chasing too few goods. So as a result, basically, the money becomes worthless. You cannot buy anything using such money, especially in a context of rising prices.
So are most currencies right now not backed by gold?
Absolutely.
Let's get back to the ZiG. It's been around for 2 weeks. It started off really well, trading quite strongly against the US dollar. 2 weeks later, things have changed. Tell us what's changed and why.
What's changed is that you recall that when it was launched on the 5th of April, 2024, the banks were given a limited time to basically change their systems from the Zimbabwean dollar to the ZiG, and also to change the basically deposits that were within their banks, the accounts of the clients, their clients, from Zimbabwean dollars to the ZiG. So basically, as that was happening, the parallel market basically started trading using the balances that are in individual accounts. Say, for example, your account has been changed into ZiG, and someone can actually approach you and say, I've got someone who is willing to buy your ZiG at a particular exchange rate. So instead of giving the 13.56 official rate, they can say offer a higher rate and say, someone is willing to buy at 18 ZiG. And then because of lack of trust and perceptions within the economy that the ZiG basically cannot hold its own against foreign currencies, people are willing to basically accept a depreciating sort of value of the ZiG. So that's what is happening now, that people offer to buy from those that have got ZiGs in their accounts, and basically they transact. And as a result, what we've seen now is that the ZiG has actually been depreciating. It has been weakening against especially the United States dollar.
So the ZiG actually doesn't exist yet as a physical currency. We're still waiting for it, are we?
Yes, to only be long, introduced at the end of the month, at the end of April.
So the black market rate of the ZiG has changed from 13.50 something to 30 ZiG per dollar. Is that a sign of things to come?
Well, yes, because the ZiG is simply replacing a poor local currency, the Zimbabwean dollar. And basically the perception is that whatever you call it does not matter. But people don't trust their local currency because of what happened in the past. The loss of their earnings, the loss of income as a result basically of rising inflation, and lack of proper management of the economy. So as a result, the perception is that the fundamentals haven't changed, and yet we've introduced a new currency. The perception is that it won't be able to hold its own against other currencies. And what also fuels such perceptions is that at its introduction, government has also exempted, for example, fuel operators. They can still charge in US dollars. So by exempting the fuel sector, what government is saying is basically that the fuel sector has to be exempted so that it can easily get foreign currency to buy, to import the fuel. So to an ordinary Zimbabwean who is earning in the local currency, that basically sends a signal that, okay, then it means I have to go out myself into the market, change my ZIG into US dollars, and buy fuel. So it implies, therefore, that government itself is not trusting its own currency. That's why it is even exempting such a critical sector as the fuel sector. So basically, that reinforces those perceptions that come from the lived experiences of Zimbabweans where they've lost value. You remember, even in 2019, when we introduced a monocurrency, the Zimbabwean dollar, it was initially pegged at 1-to-1 against the US dollar. And then later on, when we introduced an auction, it was supposed to trade at 2.5 Zimbabwean dollars to the US dollar. But however, it quickly lost its way and basically lost its value against other currencies. So basically, there is a legacy of unresolved issues of lack of trust and confidence. Because for any currency to be used as money, it must be accepted by its citizens. So the challenge in Zimbabwe is that the local citizens don't trust their own local currency.
Okay. Thank you very, very much. That's been fascinating. Thank you.
You are most welcome, Audrey.
That's the economist Godfrey Kanyenze from the Labour and Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
I knew right at that moment that my whole life was gone. I'm going to jail for a very, very long time. There was no doubt about it.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
And honestly, even at that point of reporting to a journalist, I don't think I really knew that that was in itself an act of whistleblowing.
Expect the unexpected.
The only future is death here. So if we live, we might have a chance. We will die anyway, but we will die trying.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Do you use hair relaxers? I used to, but I haven't for years. If you do, you should know that many of them contain very harmful chemicals. I know we expect companies to do better by their consumers, but that's not always the case. In 2022, the U.S. National Institute of Health, the NIH, published a study that found women who used hair relaxers more than 4 times a year were at a higher risk of uterine cancer. Following this study, and according to U.S. court records, there are at least 57 lawsuits alleging that companies knew that their products contain harmful chemicals, but continue to market and sell them anyway. In a statement posted online after the first lawsuits were filed, L'Oreal, one of the companies accused of this, said it was, and I quote, "confident in the safety of our products and believe the recent lawsuits filed against us have no legal merit." News of the harms doesn't always filter through to other countries. So places like Tunisia, Kenya and Cameroon have shown an increase in sales of perms and relaxers. In fact, sales in Kenya and Tunisia jumped by 10% over a 5-year period. South Africa and Nigeria also saw growth. I've been speaking to Shei Falodun-Liberd, co-director of Level Up, a feminist community campaigning for gender justice here in the UK, about these issues. Okay, just talk very quickly about figures that are coming out showing that many black women in the US are rejecting chemical straighteners, and there are lawsuits against the manufacturers of those chemicals, which have been shown to be really harmful to women. But in some African countries, actually, sales for hair straighteners are climbing. So what I'm wondering is, your reaction to that, are there different reactions going on in the US and here or in Africa?
I think it definitely, as you say, depends on the region. In the UK and the US, you know, the use of hair relaxers went down quite dramatically during the natural hair movement, kind of in the 2010s. But recently, the number has started to actually go back up in both the UK and the US. It's nowhere near as much as it was before, but it's still increasing. And so I think, you know, Black women relax their hair for really a number of reasons, because it's easier to manage, to avoid, you know, discrimination at work or at school. And some of them just like it. The one thing that we should be able all have in common is that we can trust the product that we're using. And unfortunately, big brands like L'Oreal aren't transparent enough and aren't accountable for the potential harms that their hair relaxers might be causing.
I'd rather we didn't use brand names, in the sense that there are lots of different brands that are being used, right, for hair relaxers and those kinds of products. Just in the general sense, can we talk about, are the products becoming safer?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, there are other brands, independent brands, smaller brands, who are doing what they can to ensure that hair relaxers are as safe as possible. I can't say for sure that they are becoming safer. You know, it is a chemical process. A lot of us, you know, that have had hair relaxers in the past know that, you know, we experience burns and kind of just accept that as a standard.
Don't we just remember those burns?
Right. And we just kind of accept that, you know, beauty is pain, right? But, you know, I think very few of us understand, like, the extent to which we could be, you know, risking our health when it comes to hair relaxers.
And it wasn't just risking our hairlines. You did a study yourself in your organization about the wider health effect. Just tell us what your study found.
There's been so much study, so much research that has come out in the last few years. And that's since, you know, Oxford University released their study saying that there was a 30% increased risk of breast cancer to Black women who use hair relaxers. And since then, like you said, there's been connection to uterine cancer, fibroids, kidney failure. And the thing that we most found was that Black women were so unaware, but we found that 77% of Black women had no idea about, like, the life-threatening risk to their health. You know, for a lot of us, we've experienced burns. For even the things that sound like they're superficial, that, you know, people experience permanent hair loss, eczema and dermatitis on the scalp and things like that. So it's not even just, you know, kind of what the things that inside that we're not seeing. There are things on the ways that it manifests on the outside that should be cause for concern.
What kind of pressure are you able to bring to bear, and how do companies actually respond when you do, you know, campaign for transparency and for safety and for health?
You know, with the organization that we're campaigning against now, their choice has been to ignore us, to obviously keep an eye on the campaign and understand, you know, what's happening in the press. But for the most part, I think there is a real disregard around the concerns of Black women. You know, in the UK, we did an open letter to L'Oreal, which was signed by almost 100, you know, prominent, influential Black women in the UK, MPs, doctors, actors, performers. And there still has been no response. For the last 3 years, we've also been asking that company for their product safety sheets to better understand what it is that they do know about their products, and for them to be able to share those with us. And what we actually need is engagement. We need these brands to listen and understand that we need transparency, we need honesty, and we need processes for accountability when harm has actually occurred.
Tell us about the campaign that you're waging with L'Oreal right now. What is the campaign about specifically?
Yeah, so the No More Lies campaign demands that big beauty brands like L'Oreal remove toxic chemicals from their hair relaxers or take them off the shelves. And for me personally and some of the other Black women at Level Up, we were very surprised, because almost every Black woman I know, myself, including myself, has had a hair relaxer at some time.
Indeed, and you're talking to somebody who's also had
exactly.
a hair relaxer. But I mean, I must say, I stopped years and years and years ago.
So, right. A lot of us did. But you know, as you said, that piece of research that, you know, she said that if four times you'd be using it four times a year. But, you know, most Black women I know will relax their hair every 6 weeks. wow, even if they lot, no longer huh? do it.
Yeah.
Right?
That's yeah, to deal yeah, with the growth, yeah, but right? even.
Yeah, exactly, because they want to be able to combat the growth. And so that's more than four times a year. And so even if you were just doing it for a short period of time in your life and you no longer do it, I am interested in understanding long-lasting effects of that is. Mm. And that's what we need L'Oreal to be more transparent about.
Why specifically L'Oreal? Because I didn't used to use L'Oreal products at all.
L'Oreal, actually the biggest hair relaxer manufacturer globally through their ownership of Dark and Lovely and Soft Sheen Carson.
Ah, of course, Dark and Lovely.
Right.
I mean, exactly. PTSD yes. immediately.
For a lot of us, right? But also at the same time, a lot of us also have very fond memories, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, the relaxer girls on the boxes and wanting to look like them.
But also your hair feels that way and it's manageable.
Exactly.
It's lovely.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, a lot of our beauty practices, particularly with our hair, are passed down generationally. We take care of our hair a particular way because our mothers took care of our hair a certain way. For a lot of us, it's a practice and it's a concern that potentially we're passing down those risks.
So what are the things that women should look out for when they're looking at the packaging? Because people are using it in African countries. You have a very young and very dynamic population, new markets opening up for businesses because people are, you know, have the income to spend on their hair and whatever choices they make. So for them to be safe, if they choose to relax their hair, what should they be looking at on the packaging?
The first point I'll make is that on the packaging, they have an ingredients list. It's usually on the bottom of the box or at the back of the box. Read through it. And if you see sodium hydroxide, if you see potassium hydroxide, if you see formaldehyde, then you know that it's a product that isn't safe for you. It's also important to say that there are a lot of brands who will have no lye. For example, lye is the general name for sodium hydroxide.
The burning
they will
agent.
Have no lye. Yes, exactly correct. They will have no lye written on the packaging. But then when you look further in the ingredients list, you see sodium hydroxide. So even for folks who think that they're making an informed decision, they're thinking they're making the right decision by choosing a product that they think is gentler or safer, it's actually not. And that's down to the lack of transparency, again, from those big brands.
So sodium hydroxide, potassium hydroxide and formaldehyde, those are the things
correct.
You need
you
to look
it.
Out for.
You got it.
Yeah, just out of interest, how do you wear your hair now?
Oh, my hair's natural. I've been natural, about 13 years now. All sorts of stuff on my hair. Braids. Love it.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
No problem at all. Take care. Bye.
Shea Falodun-Lee Bird, co-director of Level Up, a feminist community campaigning for gender justice in the United Kingdom. Focus on Africa was put together by Richard Kague in Nairobi, Patricia Whitehorn, Rob Wilson and Bella Hassan here in London. Paul Bachibinga was in charge of making sure we got things right. Our technical producer, Jonathan Greer, made sure we got on air and online on time. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
I knew right at that moment that my whole life was gone. I'm going to jail for a very, very long time. There was no doubt about it.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
And honestly, even at that point of reporting to a journalist, I don't think I really knew that that was in itself an act of whistleblowing.
Expect the unexpected.
The only future is death here. So if we live, we might have a chance. We will die anyway, but we will die trying.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.